Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Bobby Park, director and co-founder of RelyMD, about avoiding the emergency room, the role of telemedicine. I know this is something near and dear to you with your husband being an emergency room provider.
It is to me. My husband, full disclosure, is partners with Bobby Park. And so I'm especially excited just to...
You're going to find out what he does for a living.
I know, find out what it is that my husband's doing when he goes to work now. But I think it'll be great for us to really think about, with Dr. Park and others, how to reduce our utilization on the emergency room and how to, for patients to navigate care and get the care they need when they need it. But first, we are going to talk about several elements of research that matters. We've got an article about obesity and its relationship to trauma patients and orthopedic surgery and what happens to people.
We're going to talk about different forms of tobacco. Are they better? Are they worse? Are they the same in terms of cancer-causing agents, things like smokeless tobacco compared to cigarettes?
We're talking about working up a sweat. Vigorous exercise may protect men from certain types of prostate cancer.
Like that myself. And finally, we're going to talk about, if our children get breakfast, do they have better long-term success in school? Really important questions. Let's talk about our very first one, Christy, about being obese in trauma. What's this about?
This is a study that was published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, where they were looking for a link between obesity and surgery outcomes, meaning what happens to the risk for surgery in people who are obese and have a car accident, for example, or some other type of trauma. What happens to their hospital stays, to their cost? Is there a difference between people who are obese and non-obese in terms of what happens?
And we might expect that those who are obese, because they might have other problems like high blood pressure or diabetes, that there might be more complications. And I think that's exactly what they found. They looked at a little over 300 patients who had had multiple bone injuries from trauma at a major trauma center over 5 years from 2006 to 2011, and looked at those who were moderately obese or very obese and said, well, how does this look when they look at the complications once they've had the trauma? And it was pretty kind of depressing.
Yeah, it was. They found that obesity increased the risk of surgery at all. So if you were obese, you're more likely to need surgery and get surgery. If you had a normal body mass index, you were not obese, you had a shorter hospital stay. Costs were more for the obese group. And if you were obese, you were more likely to need discharge to a nursing facility versus being able to go home.
Yeah, those who were not obese were in the hospital on average after this trauma a little over seven days. And those who were obese were in the hospital for close to 10 days. And those were in the intensive care unit was, again, even longer, 12 and 16 days. And then the cost was $160,000 for those who weren't obese, still very expensive. But if they were obese, it was $234,000. So it suggests that this is a risk factor, not just potentially for bad outcomes, but much delayed healing. These are really important factors that I think we're just beginning to deal with.
I completely agree. I want to move on to our next research that matters, and that is something that is near and dear to you, related to your tobacco research. This is looking at smokeless tobacco products, so not cigarettes, but the ones that are smokeless, and to see what sort of chemicals and biomarkers in the blood are related to cancer. A lot of people think it's safer. Oh, well, it's smokeless tobacco, so this is safe and I don't need to worry about it. But this is evidence to suggest the contrary.
Yes, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has a Center for Tobacco Products, and they're really looking at and interested in what are the constituents in the tobacco products and what do we know about communicating these risks to the public. And there are a lot of people, both providers at times, patients, who believe that, for instance, smokeless tobacco is less harmful than cigarettes. And that may well be because of the total burden of smoking compared to those that are using smokeless. But the question is smokeless tobacco chewing tobacco, snuff, those sorts of things safe. And this particular research really shows in two things, Christy. One is that the levels of cotinine, which is a biomarker of exposure to nicotine, is actually higher in the smokeless tobacco than the cigarettes, indicating a much stronger exposure to perhaps nicotine, maybe more addictive. And then the exposure of at least one carcinogenic cancer-causing agent called NNK, which is also higher in these particular brands. So it clearly does not mean that it's a safe alternative to cigarettes.
Well, that is exactly the right conclusion. If you do use any sort of tobacco, but if you use smokeless tobacco, it's worth really exploring stopping that because it is not, in fact, safe.
And we really had one research study that our group did recently, Christy, where we showed among high school youth across the state of North Carolina that actually the dual use, cigarettes and something else, cigarettes and the smokeless tobacco, cigarettes and electronic cigarettes, was actually higher than a single use of just cigarettes alone, indicating that frequently it's not just one or the other, at least for youth. Actually, this dual use is a huge problem. We are just now realizing this. Communication campaigns need to take this into consideration.
Absolutely. Okay, let's talk about working up a sweat. We're talking about exercise. I feel like we talk about this almost every week because exercise is very important to you and your health. This is research looking at men who exercise, to do vigorous exercise, and following them over time to see about their risk from lethal prostate cancer.
Well, and one thing I really like about this study, Christy, is it looks at something that we've talked a little bit about the show, is that we don't really have a great screening test for prostate cancer, and yet we have treatments for it. But if a man wanted to prevent prostate cancer in the past, we would have said, well, there may be some things you can do. Some of the heart-healthy things are good for the prostate. And this study actually begins to quantify it. And it's not just exercise. They were really looking at really healthy lifestyle habits, which included a better diet, less meat in the diet for many, and not smoking, and then quantifying that there are dramatic improvements if you have this essentially heart-healthy approach actually in preventing some aggressive forms of prostate cancer.
You know, it's very exciting to see that it's nice that the same things that prevent prostate cancer are also the things that are good for your heart and good for your overall health.
Yeah, they said 47% of the most advanced prostate cancers could be prevented in the United States if men over the age of 60 had five or more of these healthy habits. So I think this is a huge take-home message for our listeners and for those who are at increased risk for prostate cancer.
Okay, this last one we have to do quickly, but unfortunately is the one that's most important to me as a mom with children in this age range. We are talking about breakfast, okay?
And skipping it or having it?
We're talking about skipping it, but then I read this and I'm like, does the Pop-Tart that I let my kids eat in the morning, does that count? So this is a study of...
I don't know.
Exactly. I can't wake up and make eggs. All right. New study, 5,000 9 to 11-year-olds looking at the positive associations really between breakfast consumption and educational outcomes. So how kids do in school and the relationship to what they eat for breakfast.
And this was published in Public Health Nutrition and basically find that the children who did eat breakfast and had a better quality breakfast, so I'm not sure it can be Pop-Tarts all the time, Christy, had better academic outcomes. It isn't just that they are more alert in school, they actually had longer-term educational attainment. This is, I think, some implications for all kinds of things because it shows a real link between what we do at home and our exposure to good nutrition and our ability to succeed.
It absolutely does. And, I mean, I read this and it does motivate me to wake up a little bit earlier and make sure we have a good, healthy breakfast
on the
table.
You're going to heat up those Pop-Tarts at least.
Exactly.
You're going to heat them up in the microwave for the kids.
Exactly.
Well done.
Exactly. Thank you.
That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Bobby Park, director and co-founder of ReliMD, about avoiding the emergency room, the role of telemedicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Bobby Park, director and co-founder of RelyMD, about avoiding the emergency room, the role of telemedicine.
Welcome, Dr. Park. Thanks for being with us.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Now, you are an emergency medicine physician by training and obviously an entrepreneur as well. How did you become passionate about emergency medicine as your area of expertise?
That one is interesting. So I went to med school with the idea I was going to be a surgeon. And that didn't take very long to switch very quickly. You sort of gravitate towards people you look up to. And I really have to say I admired and wanted to sort of copy folks who I admired quite a bit in the emergency department. I also found myself gravitating towards acute care in all fields. And so it was an easy fit. And I also like the sort of overall mentality of work very hard, play very hard sort of mentality. So it fit with my own personality.
Well, let's dive right in with actually a question, which is there's an assumption that emergency rooms are crazily busy and sometimes over busy. Is that the case? And or is it just that, you know, some places sometimes are too busy and the craziness? What do we know?
Yeah, that's a tough one because I would say that it depends on the emergency department. For sure, there are now facilities where it is not unusual to have 2, 4, 6 hour waits to be seen. But I think it depends on the community you're in. There are freestanding emergency departments and other types of emergency departments that pop up when they're new. They typically have a lower census and the wait time's a little lower. But then eventually once folks find those places exist, then the census becomes a little bit more consistent, a little bit busier. So yes, it is not unheard of to have many hour waits, but it's also in the triangle here, my group, Wake Emergency Physicians, PA, Professional Association, the acronym is WEPA. We call ourselves WEPA. WEPA staffs, for example, 9 emergency departments in the Greater Triangle area. Of those 9 emergency departments, the waits can be anywhere from 0 wait, 15-minute waits on some of the quieter, smaller emergency departments, all the way to many, many hours at the main campuses.
And one of the things that's hard for patients to know is, do they need to go to the emergency department? And then if they get there, if it's something small and there are people very sick, they might need to wait a really long time. But it's hard for patients to know that ahead of time. Is that pretty accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, I've said this I don't know how many times, but I quit judging people's emergencies a long time ago as a physician. Folks come in for straightforward things like bronchitis or a hangnail. I'm exaggerating there. But there are definitely conditions that people don't recognize as being mundane when they're sick. They're scared. And so they go to the emergency department. So again, I quit judging people's emergencies a long time ago. However, the statistic is about 40% of emergency room visits are considered don't necessarily need that acute level of care. So you can imagine 30 to 40% extra folks who are in the mix, they're going to be waiting quite a while if they're deemed not acute.
Let's say that you don't know, and let's say you can get in and you can be seen quickly and within an hour because there's no wait at the particular facility, there's still a problem. And I mean, I have a relative recently, a pretty young, healthy person who went in and they had a hospital bill of $4,000 after about 2 hours. That's a problem. So it's not just the length of time. It's also that this care is expensive by its nature, or is that wrong?
No, that's absolutely right. There's a lot of factors that go into why emergency medicine bills are so high. I think at the crux of it, there's a federal mandate that no matter who comes to the emergency room, you have to be seen.
You can't say no.
We cannot say no. We do not biopsy their wallet. We take a look at them. We find out what's wrong. We do a screening exam. We manage them. We treat them regardless of ability to pay. And that's a federal mandate. And so you can imagine there's a significant number of patients who may or may not have insurance. Therefore, when there's about 25% of those folks who don't pay their bill and perhaps can't pay their bill, Well, those costs become averaged out amongst the entire paying group. So it's a little bit of cost shifting, basically.
So help us understand ReliMD and your interest in entrepreneurship and thinking about some of these issues about patients either waiting a long time or maybe who don't need to be in the emergency department, navigate the system a little bit.
ReliMD is the telemedicine or telehealth arm of our emergency medicine services, wholly owned by WEPA. So ReliMD came about, I would say, about 3 or 4 years ago as an idea in our head. And our group, WEPA, is fairly progressive. We realized that there was going to be change in healthcare systems, reimbursement models, a switch to value-based care. And so our group—
Which means, just to define that for our listeners.
That is a new model of payment and reimbursement from payers like insurance companies and the government like Medicare and Medicaid to physicians and other healthcare entities based on their quality of care and not necessarily the services that they're billing.
So if you kept someone out of the emergency room, you actually might get reimbursed more by taking care of them in the emergency room.
That's correct.
If that was an appropriate utilization
of care. If it's appropriate, correct.
So you're reading the tea leaves saying, okay, everything's going value-based care. There are these challenges. We got to get ahead of it.
That's right, Christy. So we then decided, well, what can we do to bring, as an emergency medicine group, something to the table to value-based care? How do we stay viable? What helps us stay independent? Our group is an independent democratic group. So we looked at telemedicine as that solution. We looked at a bunch of ideas. In fact, I was fortunate enough to take that role as the business development officer of our group. And I brought some really not so great ideas to the table. But then this is the one that stuck. And as I looked into the details more and more and more, it seemed more promising. It seemed to fit with what we provide in the emergency room. And so I pitched it to our group, just like I would pitch it to a venture capitalist company. I came with a business plan. I asked them for X number of dollars over the next 3 years to prove that we could do this. And they voted. It's a democratic group, so everyone gets a vote. And we voted yes.
Well, you also have an interesting experience from your personal family that kind of convinced you this was a good thing. Can you share that with us?
Absolutely. So, and I think this probably goes for all of us as physicians. There are friends, family, church friends who they have an illness or an injury and they curbside you, just call you on your cell phone, perhaps text you some pictures and ask you your opinion. And they'll say things like, well, what do you think? Does this need stitches? Does this need to go to the emergency room? And that happens to me weekly. And in this particular case, it was my sister who's in Oakland, California, and her daughter, my niece, Emmy, fell off the monkey bar and got a little gash in her hand. And so she texted me a whole bunch of pictures. I asked her to try to spread it apart and take some more pictures. And at the end of the day, it did not need stitches. It could be washed and taken care of easily without having to go to the ER. And she did great. And my sister was so thankful because that's a 3 to 4 hour wait at Children's Oakland for sure. And
probably could have been $1,000 for one reason or another. Could have been.
Easily. Yep. Absolutely.
Easily. And so that's when it started coming around. Wait a minute. This is a service that we could provide.
Absolutely. It's a clinical need that's out there. And we thought, well, given technology advancing so well, so rapidly these days, I think this is something that's doable.
That's great. Well, we want to hear more about this and how it's developed into something that patients can see a doctor and get their care through telemedicine. But we do need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Bobby Park, director and co-founder of ReliMD, about avoiding the emergency room, the role of telemedicine. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Bobby Park, director and co-founder of RelyMD, about avoiding the emergency room and the role of telemedicine. Dr. Park, before the break, you were telling us a little bit about the reason for thinking outside the box and moving this ahead with telemedicine. And a couple weeks ago or months ago, Adam and I talked on the show about telemedicine between rural hospitals and doctor to doctor. But this is different. It's patient to doctor. Explain to us a little bit about how RelyMD works from a patient perspective.
So you're exactly right. It is different because it is from patient to doctor. The patient basically makes an account, same as they would an email account. Then they get into the system. They tell us what's wrong, so basically a chief complaint. They currently, as it is right now, our service, RelyMD, is completely outside of insurance, so it is paid for by credit card. And then so you put your credit card information in, and you are in the virtual waiting room. And our job and our goal is to get to that patient within 10 minutes of entering the system. We get back in touch with them by internet web browser, so on their laptop or their desktop through a webcam, or they can use our RelyMD app. There is an iOS app that's works on smartphones or tablets, as well as an Android. So lots of different ways to interact with us. Once we're on there with you, we have a video component and audio component. So we basically ask you a lot of questions. We do a focused examination based on what the complaint is, and then we render care. A lot of the times, it's just advice, reassurance, education about what it is. Sometimes it's early, you're not sure what it is, but that's kind of what our job is frequently in the emergency room. It's not to know what exactly it is, but it's not a life-threatening emergency. So that in and of itself oftentimes has value. And if need be, if there's a prescription that's warranted, we can call that prescription in to your preferred pharmacy, and that's done electronically.
So I imagine that this works really well when it's an example, like you mentioned, of your niece and something that you can see and be really confident. Can you give us another example of where it works well and then another example perhaps of where it's challenging because it's not so straightforward?
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe someone with chest pain or someone who's wanting perhaps pain medicine or how you handle just complex things.
Right now, the sweet spot on this direct-to-consumer telemedicine is, the way I would describe it, is online urgent care. So poison ivy, rashes, infections, sore throats, UTI symptoms,
Urinary tract infections,
exactly. Thank you. Basic illnesses that are horribly annoying, and today's consumer and patient, oftentimes they're not willing to wait. You know, people are busy, they have schedules, and the last thing they want to do is take half a day to go to the urgent care or potentially have to wait a few days, perhaps to see their primary care physician. So for these unscheduled care needs, we always felt like there was a demand and there was a need for that. So that's how we sort of framed it. As far as chest pain, difficulty breathing, anything 911, you know, this is not online CPR for sure. Anything 911 is the very first thing on our website. It shows that if you're having an emergency, to call 911. It's not a 911 substitute, even though we are emergency physicians. And then I'll just share our experiences here is that 9 out of 10 calls right now that we get are urgent care type symptoms. There is, however, 1 out of 10 that is a little more complex, and they require an in-person evaluation.
Give us an example of a complex one.
Sure. A perfect example is we had a young lady who was riding her bicycle, and she fell, gashed her face, had a head injury, so she was having a headache and some dizziness. She went to the local emergency department, and 4 hours later, she was frustrated because she hadn't been seen. She then said, well, I'm not going to wait in this ER anymore, got up and went to a different ER in her hometown. So drove 30 minutes, went to that ER. 3.5 hours into that ER visit, she was about to have a nervous breakdown. Her husband said, oh my goodness, I forgot. We have this RelyMD thing through work. And so went in the parking lot, accessed us through their iPhone. Our physician who was on evaluated her, asked her a bunch of questions, did a focused neuro exam. For sure, she needed stitches. For sure, she also warranted a head CT. And so basically gave that patient options because she didn't know what else to do at that point. Number one, you could for sure wait in that area in that emergency department because eventually you will be seen. But other options include you could go because she needed, again, facial stitches and a head CT. So that kind of ups the ante. You can't just go to urgent care for that. So there are within 30 minutes of her, there were three other emergency departments. And one of them happened to be our emergency department where she had a relationship with the physicians. And it's one of our EDs. We explained that she can go to any of them. We would call any of them and let that doctor know that she was coming, hopefully to try and grease the wheels a little bit and get her seen sooner.
So a high level interaction and the advice and the triage and navigating. So in this particular case, your value is that you're an advocate for what the patient needed.
Exactly. This is straight up population health. This is care coordination for unscheduled care needs. So then this patient chose for option D, which was our ER, because we could call ahead. We knew that the wait there was 15 minutes because we have an app for our ER, so we know the wait times. And so she chose for that one. 90 minutes later, she had her face stitched up, her head CT was negative, and she was relieved and happy.
So the other question is how you, there are a couple of different questions that come up. One is you mentioned sore throat. So something mm-hmm. like a sore throat, people are worried, do they have strep throat or not? There are different things you can figure out with probability, but I wonder how you'll monitor over prescriptions for antibiotics. People mm-hmm. have paid, they want something to prevent your group from over prescribing. And then the other question that came to mind was about coordination with their primary care doctors. Mm-hmm.
So the great question, a perfect example of the sore throat. So I get it that there are outcome measurements that physicians are being held to, including things like overprescription of antibiotics. So that's one where our group has looked at the evidence, and we basically, for sore throat, go with the modified center criteria, which is just a scoring system for pharyngitis. Not a perfect scoring system, but one that's been looked at and validated. So at the end of the day, we call these, you know, we've looked at various symptoms and we made clinical guidelines. Mm-hmm. And we called them guidelines because ultimately we didn't want to dictate anything for our physicians. Our physicians, we feel very strong, you know, they're top-tier physicians, they all practice in a certain way, and the last thing we wanted to do is dictate how they rendered care. So we called them clinical guidelines, and at the end of the day, we all recognize that over-prescribing antibiotics is an issue, so it's not just an antibiotic mill. It's definitely not just a pain pill mill, which, by the way, before I forget, we don't prescribe any controlled substances, so that includes narcotics, certain sleep medications, certain psychiatric medications, and lifestyle drugs. I wanted to bring
no
up.
No Viagra.
Yeah.
No Viagra. Sorry. Okay. There's the Alice there.
You know, we probably have time for one or two real quick questions. And one of them is that we don't really see too many physicians that are as entrepreneurial as I think you and some of your colleagues are. And maybe just a real quick comment about where you see room for this entrepreneurial, this business approach in medicine. Is it something that we need to do more of or proceed cautiously?
I personally think there should be more of this because, okay, so I say it all the time. Whenever there is challenges in the healthcare system, that is opportunity for someone. And for our group, that's how we saw this. And what I mean by opportunity is an opportunity to bring better care at a better value. And so 10 years from now, I want people to think, well, of course we use ReliMD to figure out, you know, what to do exactly. You know, we weren't 100% sure urgent care or ER or our own doctor. You know, of course we spent 10, 15 minutes firsthand checking out ReliMD, and actually we didn't have to go anywhere. They just handled it. So when there is opportunity like this where reimbursement landscapes are changing and there are different people are begging for solutions. I mean, just look at Medicaid reform. People are begging for solutions that they don't know the answers. Well, physicians, in my opinion, should try and step up and help be a part of that. And whether it be through entrepreneurship or biomedical devices, believe it or not. I know there's a whole lot of that going on, but especially on the policy side, because again, when it comes to health access, it is such a need right now. And with, again, the changing reimbursement models, no one knows where that's going to land. And so I think it's, if we, you know, rather than just be on the sidelines kind of complaining about it, I honestly believe that physicians need to be more in there and trying to help shape the solution.
Yeah, well, you're on the field.
Yeah, we appreciate your leadership with what you're doing. I mean, this is really making a difference in a big way and solving a need. So thank you for the effort that you've put in. Thanks for taking time to explain it to us. And we look forward to hearing more about what the next steps are with your product.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being our guest.
We've been talking with Dr. Bobby Park, director and co-founder of RelyMD, about avoiding the emergency room and the role of telemedicine. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about our listeners' health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, we want you to send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question. Daniel?
My 42-year-old husband is trying to be better about exercise and diet. And with the holidays coming up, I wanted to get him something either food prep or exercise related. Do you have any recommendations?
What a great and timely question. Healthy gifts for the holidays. It's a great question. But one thing that came to mind, and I don't know how much you're interested in spending or what you're looking for, but there are certain plans that you can get with local farmers markets, or there are delivery services where they will deliver organic, fresh, locally grown fruits and vegetables to your home. And if you could get a gift like that, that it would keep on giving and you'd have fresh fruit and vegetable around, that could be a really positive step.
You know, Christy, my daughter subscribed to that for our family last year.
Really? Great minds think alike.
And all of a sudden, I noticed all these incredible eggplants showing up at our house, but with recipes, too. The other thing that reminds me of something really good are the Fitbits. And, you know, I sometimes kind of poo-pooed them a little bit like a fad, but I've had patients, Christy, who tell me that it's the reason they've lost weight. And now I think there's a secondary market that one could get these Fitbits really inexpensive. You know, we should do like our top 10 kind of holiday gift list for your health.
I think that's a great idea. I have several others that came to my mind. But you know what? We are going to charge Daniel with helping us make a little list. We'll come up with it, the two of us, and posting it on our blog as just ideas for healthy gifts for the holidays.
And we'll bring up a few more at our very next show.
Let's do it. Let's take our next House Call question, Daniel.
I'm a 55-year-old female. I used to take Tums every now and again for heartburn, but for the past few months, I've been taking it daily for calcium. Recently, I've been getting frequent and really stubborn heartburn that doesn't really respond to the Tums. What's going on there?
Well, it's not working right now.
That's right.
There's a problem here, mission control, and I think this is not a straightforward one, but we'll hear some thoughts. Christy, what are your thoughts?
One thought is that sometimes you can get heartburn that is an inflammation in your stomach, something called gastritis, where it gets really irritated. Or you could have reflux. Heartburn, a lot of times, is a word that people use for the feeling of where you're having that acid reflux coming up into your esophagus. And sometimes, based on what's going on in your life or your diet or other things, that can become worse. There are medications other than Tums that can be very helpful for that, and it might be worth a trial. I would talk with your doctor about it, but it might be worth doing a trial of those over-the-counter proton pump inhibitors, or there's H2 blockers, different medicines like Zantac, Prilosec, other things that might be worth trying for a week or two to see if it makes it better.
We should always remember, we had a guest on our show, Christy, a renowned cardiologist from New York City,
yep,
who mentioned to us a couple years ago that particularly in women, mm-hmm, perhaps we aren't as attuned to potentially manifestations of heart disease. So let's not always jump to the conclusion as our listeners are assuming. So if it doesn't seem right, it may not be. And finally, something that we see down south, but I'm sure it's across the country, is sometimes people, when it hurts, they take pain medicine. And the one that's real frequent around here is goodies powders. And those goodies powders contain lots of aspirin and salicylates, and those can really be upsetting to the stomach, cause that gastritis you talked about.
Absolutely.
So a lot of possibilities. I agree. Talk to your doctor.
Okay, let's take our next heartburn question, but our next house call question.
I'm a 34-year-old female, and I've been told I have muscle tension headaches by one doctor and migraine headaches by another. Another doctor says I have both, and I've been on lots of medication. What should I do?
Well, this is a common occurrence and sometimes a difficult occurrence, which is you're getting kind of little differing advice or at least different opinions as to what's going on. And I think perhaps a lot of these times it's not straightforward. And at one point in time, maybe it is a muscle tension. One time, maybe it's a migraine, or maybe it is both. What do you think, Christy?
Well, and I also think that as we are learning more things in medicine, there is a movement towards an approach to these kinds of headaches. It doesn't matter so much. Was it a muscle-related stress headache, or was it a migraine? Because in many ways, they have overlapping and similar features. So it may just be that the doctors are using different words. But what really matters is that you're getting some relief from your headaches, both in what to do when they come on, and also starting to identify what things bring on headaches for you so that you can begin avoiding those things or changing your life in a way that makes it better. So we often have people keep a headache diary to start trying to tease out which things are triggering headaches.
Dear diary, one of the things that's important is to remember that sometimes people take Tylenol or Motrin or those medicines for both types of headaches. And unfortunately, those medicines, if you take them daily, can cause those types of headaches. So do talk with your doctor about this, understand better, maybe figure out ways we can prevent both and get better.
One other piece of advice, since you have differing doctors with different opinions, it's important for something like headaches to really stick with a doctor, follow up with that doctor, come in with the information, because that relationship over time is often where you make the most gains.
Daniel, what's our very last house call?
My husband is 54, and he's been on medications for anxiety and depression. Over the past year, he's been doing much better, but he still gets a little of both. When is it safe for him to stop either or both medications?
Well, that's a good question and a really common question that I think a lot of our patients and family members have, which is your own medicines for anxiety or depression. When can you stop them?
Well, sometimes the medicine, and it's hard to know without knowing the names, but you may be on something called an SSRI, something like Lexapro, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft. There are a bunch of different ones. And those medications are the medicines you take every single day for a period of time. And it's usually 6 months, sometimes a year. Sometimes people need them ongoing even longer. The medicines often given for short-term anxiety, these benzodiazepines, medicines like Klonopin, Xanax, Ativan, those types of medicines are really not super helpful to be on long-term and are often used in the short-term while you're getting on that other medication that helps also improve anxiety symptoms. It's complicated without knowing. I mean, it's hard to give advice without knowing exactly what medicines you're on.
And in this particular circumstance, it isn't totally resolved. I usually say it should be totally resolved for at least 6 months, preferentially for a year, before you really think about making withdrawal of the medications. Work with the therapist. Cognitive behavioral therapy, Christy and I talk about it a lot, can be really helpful. Well, Christy, I think that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to our listeners. They can share their own questions and stories at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Bobby Park. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.